This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf. Back in 1799, the Seneca Indians faced catastrophe as settlers encroached on their land. That's when one of their leaders had a vision with two prophets.
One named Jesus Christ and the other named George Washington. And Jesus says, you know, make sure that you carry out your mission to revitalize your people.
Today on Backstory, a history of religious revivals and the leaders who fuel them, at home, in churches, and on the airwaves.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow, and I'm here with Peter Onuf.
Hey, Brian.
And Ed Ayers is with us.
Hey, Brian, Peter.
We're going to begin today in the early 1700s. That's when pastors in New England started worrying that young people were turning away from God.
So there was a sense that they needed what they called a revival of religion.
This is Thomas Kidd, a historian at Baylor University. He says these pastors started praying for something big to happen where people would renew their relationships with Jesus and take up the cause of spreading the faith.
And it's one of those classic historical chicken and egg questions. They start praying a lot for revival to come, and guess what? It comes. And so, you know, whatever you think about prayer, they sure are talking about revival an awful lot, and it comes in force starting in the 1730s.
This upsurge of Protestant energy in the 1730s and 1740s came to be known as the First Great Awakening, and it played out in an especially interesting way for a woman in Plainfield, Connecticut, by the name of Mercy Wheeler.
When Mercy was 20 years old, this was in the mid-1720s, she fell ill with the burning ague, something like malaria. A looseness in her joints left her unable to walk and sometimes too weak to speak. On her worst days, her family couldn't be sure she was even alive, and this went on for years. But Mercy also had periods of clarity. In those times, she devoted herself to reading the Bible.
She begins to wonder if it was possible that as she read in the Gospels, in the New Testament, and in the book of Acts, where there are routine reports, especially in Christ's ministry, of miraculous healings, she begins to think through whether she might receive a miraculous healing.
17 years after becoming bedridden, Mercy Wheeler was still focused on this notion that God might heal her. In 1743, she set up a revival meeting in her home and invited a visiting minister to preach a sermon. But when that meeting finally arrived, Mercy began to get a little nervous.
She is going through some turmoil in her own mind because she's waiting. She's thinking, well, maybe I was presumptuous. Maybe it's not going to happen. The meeting is continuing on, and she's waiting, and not much seems to be happening.
Then suddenly, everything changed. Powerful Bible passages flashed across Mercy's mind.
One of them is to the effect of, if you will believe, you will see the glory of God. And she starts hearing that repeated in her mind. And then she starts to involuntarily, as she described it, shake. And she starts to feel a kind of warmth or power that's coursing through her body. She starts to feel her joints tightening up. And then, sure enough, she is able to stand up and start walking around the room. And everybody is just totally stunned.
Everybody, including the guest preacher who didn't see it coming at all.
Yeah, he tells her to sit down. He says that she's in a frenzy. That's the term that he uses. And he says, what do you do? You need to sit down. This is dangerous. You can't walk.
But Mercy could walk, and she continued to walk up until she died in 1796 at the age of 90.
Now, you might think that those clergymen who had prayed for the renewal of New Englanders' faith would celebrate such an amazing story. But when, with the help of her parish minister, Mercy Wheeler published her story and it circulated in print, it encountered a bit of a different response. And that's because Protestants in the modern age believed that God's work now manifested itself in natural ways, and spontaneous healing didn't fit that mold. Again, Thomas Kidd.
There's a tension about how much we should reasonably expect the revivals to be full of wonders and amazing things happening and unexpected developments up to and including things that seem miraculous.
Visions of Jesus, bleeding icons, these were the sorts of things that conservative Protestants scorned. They saw them as Catholic trickery. But radical revivalists celebrated Mercy's story, and debates about its legitimacy swirled in Boston newspapers for decades.
Miracle or not, Mercy's story got attention, which, when you think about it, is notable in its own right. Here's a woman with no religious authority who had interpreted the Bible, published a testimony, and incited a theological debate. Thomas Kidd says that Mercy's story illuminates a shift in religious authority that took place during the First Great Awakening. It was a revival movement that democratized religion, giving powerful voice to all kinds of individuals.
Where in 18th century America can women and African Americans and slaves and Native Americans and children voice their most strongly felt opinions and testify about their experiences and be taken seriously in public? There is no other venue but revivalist Christianity that they can do that.
It's Easter season, a time for renewal, reflection, and rebirth. While eggs, bunnies, and other symbols of springtime fill the shopping aisles, for Christians, this is the season when Christ's resurrection is celebrated. It's a time for recommitment to the founding principles of the Christian faith. Cycles of renewal, in fact, define much of American religious history. Throughout our past, we can identify periodic upswings of religious energy. And today on the show, we're going to explore these seasons of revival.
We'll consider a few of the most prominent leaders of revival movements, like Billy Graham, who has provided counsel to half a century's worth of American presidents, and Amy Semple McPherson, a master of modern media in the pre-television age. We'll also hear stories of charismatic leaders from earlier eras.
But first, I'd like for us to puzzle a little bit over that powerful story that Thomas Kidd told us about Mercy Wheeler and the First Great Awakening. Peter, it seems to me that Thomas Kidd talks persuasively about the connections between that story and big patterns in American history. And I wonder if you could help us figure out how we connect these individual accounts with those big stories.
Well, what Thomas Kidd is doing and historians do is connecting a lot of dots, because there is no such thing as a movement. It's what we make of what people are doing and what they're experiencing. And there was a feeling in the 18th century, in the 1740s especially, that this was the grace of God descending on America.
That's the First Great Awakening,
That's
right?
The First Great Awakening, right.
Okay.
But it's only in the 19th century when revival fires are burning again in what we now call the Second Great Awakening that the idea that there had been a First Great Awakening emerges, and that George Whitefield's travels across the continent, Jonathan Edwards' revival in Northampton, Massachusetts, all of these things are drawn together. The dots are connected. They become the feature attractions in this great panoramic story that tells us who we are as Americans and who we are as Christians. And it's that search for meaning, which is, after all, what revivals are about, is searching for meaning. That's what's happening in the Second Great Awakening.
So are you saying, Peter, that even during the so-called First Great Awakening, people like Whitefield and Edwards, not to mention our protagonists here, Mercy Wheeler, they don't really realize they're part of a great awakening, regardless of their own awakening?
Well, they do believe that something important is happening. They know it. When 30,000 people gather in a field in Middletown, Connecticut,
yeah,
to hear Whitefield, you know something is going
before
on
before football it's even
That's
invented.
Exactly right. So this is a mass phenomenon. There's no mistake about that. But what are they doing, Brian? They're focused on God. They're focused on what they see to be a great shower of grace.
And they're focused on their own heart, their own sinfulness, right?
Their own heart And the work of the Christian dispensation, the restoration of the kingdom of God on earth, what an amazing thing. So there are different interpretive schemes that are in play. That's what I would say. And with Mercy Wheeler, her major concern is not to advance the cause of women. Her major concern is with her own connection with God and to share that with her loved ones and to hope that she could inspire and spark their conversions as well.
And that's a very humane view, Peter, that I really endorse. But where does revivalism fit into this? I mean, that seems to be an intersection of history and religious faith.
Yeah.
I mean, the people themselves would have said, we've backslid because of this or that, you know, sort of secular purpose.
Yeah.
Now let's reclaim through religion an authentic
connection. We're
going to
make religion everything, in other words.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think what revivalism shows us are ways in which the people do their own history, and the tradition of revivalism is a kind of vernacular, popular history, and it both makes sense out of the past, it shapes your future, but I think most importantly, that notion of revival tradition anchors you in your world as part of a larger faith community over time.
So, Peter, at the risk of being overly social scientific here,
yeah,
does this revivalist impulse appeal particularly to marginalized people, marginalized within the world they're living in, which means they need to look back to this previous world to reclaim their authenticity?
Yeah, Brian, I think there is a sense of possibility of becoming part of that faith community, because that's what a revival is. That's the evangelical impulse, is to bring people in. It's not in order to promote the democratic project or lead to our notion of a better future, perhaps. It's instead to complete the work of God and to ecstatically connect with that world, to experience it. And yes, the doors open, the tent gets bigger, and those moments are moments that religious people cherish in their own faith tradition, because then they see their mission fulfilled. But it's also moments that people from other traditions can see and admire, that is the reach of these communities, the possibility of a human solidarity transcending narrow tribal, familial, dynastic connections, reaching to a larger world. I think that is a source of inspiration for religious and non-religious people.
And that's the spirit, especially of evangelical Christianity, right? The tribalism, the tribe can grow exponentially.
Yes,
it doesn't matter who you've been before. Now you can become reborn in Christ and be a part of this community.
Yes.
But this impulse to bring everybody into the tent faces the fact that not everybody wants to come into the tent,
right.
You know, that it's constantly trying to evangelize America, which leads to all kinds of social consequences.
And it suggests that all men could be made equal in ways that deny our sense of who we are. That is, you want me to be born again on your terms? Well, that's an offer, that's an opportunity, but that's also a negation of everything I know I am.
And that's why I think every time there's been a revival, whatever we might want to call it, whenever it is, it always comes with all this social tension surrounding it. It holds out the promise of America finally coming to its own. It also holds out the promise of America becoming something it was never meant to be.
Walk, just a closer walk with thee.
It's time for us to take a quick break, but stick around. When we get back, a momentous religious vision that features, of all people, George Washington.
Granted, Jesus is my plea.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
We're back with Backstory. I'm Peter Ronoff.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Bellow. Today on the show, we're reviving the history of Christian revivalism in America. In the first part of our show, we talked a little about what historians refer to as the First Great Awakening. And as Peter mentioned, people apparently didn't stay awake for very long because a few decades later, there was something called the Second Great Awakening.
This was a series of revivals at the very dawn of the 19th century. It was especially pronounced in Western New York, which became known as the Burned Over District for all the fires of religious conversion that engulfed the region.
This frontier region was in the throes of rapid and disorienting change as settlers and speculators swarmed across the countryside. And it wasn't just disorienting for the white settlers, because this was Indian country. This was the land of the five nations of the Iroquois Confederacy. The Seneca Indians, one of the five nations, were already in the midst of serious and wrenching change. Now they had to fight incursions by white farmers onto their traditional lands. All of this set the stage for a Seneca religious revival. Historian Matthew Dennis has written about this movement, a movement that centered on a 65-year-old man named Handsome Lake. It began on a June day in 1799.
What happens is that Handsome Lake is sick, so he's not feeling well. He's in the house of his daughter, and his daughter notices that he gets up and says, "Where are you going?" And she knows he's not feeling well. So he says, basically, I need to go out and I'll be back in a moment. So he leaves, he goes around the side of his house and he collapses and he goes into this state and seems to die to many eyewitnesses. They call for his half-brother, Corn Planter. People are gathering around and he's in this state for about 2 hours. And then he wakes up. And he talks to Corn Planter and tells him about what he's seen and where he's been and what he's heard and what he's learned. And people come together and they're persuaded by his testimony of what happens. Mm-hmm. So this happens on June 15th, 1799, and it goes on from there with a series of other visions and revelations.
So, Matt, tell us about what Handsome Lake related from that revelation he had.
During his visions, he somehow goes to this place, which seems heaven-like in many ways. And just before he gets there, he meets a couple of other prophets, one named Jesus Christ and the other named George Washington.
All right.
Yeah, which is, you know, pretty interesting. And Jesus Christ welcomes him and affirms him and says, make sure that you carry out your mission to, you know, revitalize your people, more or less. And he encounters four angels, emissaries from a great creator. Mm-hmm. And they conveyed the message of the creator to him. And one of the things that was important is that they stressed the sins or transgressions that should be avoided. You know, when they went through and delineated those, and then Handsome Lake passed those on to his people. Among the most important is whiskey. And so there's this message that's very strong that Handsome Lake conveys that they should forswear alcoholic beverages, which, you know, puts them right in the center of the kind of larger movements for temperance in American society.
Well, so Handsome Lake knew what he was talking about. He was a heavy drinker himself, right?
He was. And in fact, in the kind of gospel-like writings that emerge later, beginning in oral tradition and then in writings, he kind of embodies that himself. He's the exemplar of that. And he, you know, goes through his drunkenness and comes out of it. And that's supposed to really model how Seneca people should act. And what seems to be most important is dealing with some of the chief dangers and transgressions that are causing peril in Seneca mm-hmm. society. So through a series of visions until he dies in 1815, he laid out ultimately this kind of new kind of social gospel for Senecas, which they could follow, and it would bind them together based on their traditional beliefs and their confidence that they could endure in a really changed world.
The power of Handsome Lake's teachings is that it's a blend of Christianity and traditional Seneca beliefs, so that even if it requires this kind of renovation or reform of the community, it's in affirmation of Seneca identity.
Exactly. And the things that will affirm that identity and allow them to survive continue. So, for example, Handsome Lake is against dancing and frolicking and gaming. But he's not against traditional kind of dancing, and he's not against traditional kind of games that are incorporated into, say, the midwinter festival or other events in their ritual calendar.
And this galvanized the community. I mean, people were really excited about this.
It's complicated because you have Handsome Lake as a kind of center, and then you have those who are traditional in a way that's kind of pre-Handsome Lake, and they're suspicious of him, perhaps maybe politically or socially. But increasingly, I think his messages are very, very strong, and they're widely disseminated because they seem to offer a way to survive. You know, you can't overestimate the dangers that Senecas and other Native people in Western New York felt and experienced. So I think he affirmed their identity and their integrity and their solidarity, and allowed them in particular to come together to prevent the thing that would most likely destroy them, which was the loss of their land. And so one of the things that Handsome Lake emphasized is no land sales, and in that, he was broadly affirmed by his followers.
So what were some of the other injunctions or teachings that Handsome Lake passed on from the Great Spirit in this effort to reform himself and his people?
Well, in addition to his efforts to stamp out drink, he offered some words that seemed to really run against the trends in Seneca society, especially with regard to gender organization of families. One of the things that I think he was really committed to, and I think this is something that really resonated among his people, was to reconstruct Seneca families. But his way of doing it was quite different from tradition, because what he prescribed was a kind of patriarchal organization where men would have much greater power than they had traditionally in Iroquois life. Iroquois society was matrilineal, which means that they would, you know, reckon descent through the mother's line. The people would live in their mother's houses. Clans were organized this way. So women were really very important in that way, and they were at the key of subsistence in Seneca life as the agriculturalists, the people who produced most of their food. So what he was seemed to be pushing was a new structure where men would be much more in control and in charge of families in a way that seemed much closer to the white society surrounding. Mm-hmm. Most Senecas themselves didn't ultimately agree. The women pushed back and didn't give up the kind of status that they had acquired. And so the prophecies themselves went through a lot of negotiation and were controversial. And although they were adopted and effective, you know, they shifted a lot over time and ultimately became much less patriarchal than the original revelations would suggest.
So, Matt, let's look out into the distant future. That would be our present. What's the long-term effect of Handsome Lake's teachings for the Seneca people?
Well, Handsome Lake's revival led to the survival of the Senecas. They were able to hold on to their land base and to fend off speculators and, maintain their sovereignty. And so their traditional beliefs, as revitalized by Handsome Lake, were really at the center of this. And so while the so-called frontier pushed west and Native people in the east were removed across the Mississippi, they were able to stay. And there were attempts to remove them. These were fought off. And so, you know, today there are reservations, vital communities that continue to exist in New York State. I think without this revitalization or something else like it, that wouldn't be the case.
Matthew Dennis is a historian at the University of Oregon. He's the author of Seneca Possessed: Indians, Witchcraft, and Power in the Early American Republic.
This is Backstory, and we're talking about the history of religious revivals in America. That history tends to coalesce around charismatic leaders who have inspired large followings, leaders who have managed to make very old religious teachings relevant to new generations of Americans. Each of these preachers spoke to their audience in a way that appealed to that particular generation. We can think back to someone like Jonathan Edwards in the 18th century, who was remembered for conjuring up the fear of damnation. Or, a century later, there was Henry Ward Beecher. He was all about the gospel of love.
And there's been another strain in American preaching. Historian Randall Stevens has written about one man's gospel of humor in the years leading up to the turn of the 20th century.
So the image that a lot of Americans probably have of the Southern preacher, the classic kind of view of a Southern preacher, is he's very serious, and that the message that they are peddling is of sin and salvation, or hell and damnation. But in the case of Sam Jones, who was a famous preacher in the 1880s and the 1890s, that wasn't the case at all. One reporter said that Sam Jones furnished more fun than two comedians.
The best way in the world to kill an enemy is to love him to death. Then you don't have to bury him.
Not dispensing with judgment and sort of fire and brimstone, but bringing humor into his services in a way that was really appealing to most of his audiences. He would even make jokes about hell, about who would be going to hell. I mean, one of his most famous phrases, Sam Jones, is the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Now, whiskey's a good thing in its place, and that place is in hell. If I get there, I'll drink it all I can get, but I won't do it here.
It was as if he was just talking to you in your parlor. You know, he actually makes fun of these kind of uptown preachers in cities like Atlanta or Nashville who have divinity degrees and doctoral degrees. And there's one of his witticisms that kind of picks up on this that I think is really funny.
Half the literary preachers in this town are ABs, PhDs, DDs, LLDs, and ASSs.
He was traveling constantly by railroad, crisscrossing the country, going thousands of miles to do a week at a time of revival services. So trains were such an important part of his ability to reach so many Americans. Jones is having these major revivals in every large city in the country. So in New York City, in San Francisco, in Chicago. So he really makes a name for himself well beyond the South. He is probably one of the most recognized names in America at the time. And one of his very forceful critics was actually the writer Mark Twain. Twain writes this short story. Mark Twain is traveling on a train to heaven along with Sam Jones. And when they get to heaven, St. Peter thinks that Sam Jones is such a nuisance. He's loud, he's obnoxious. So St. Peter is looking at his train ticket, trying to see if it's actually valid, trying to find some way that he can kick him out of heaven. And Sam caterwauls and is hollering for the Lord so much in heaven that everybody decides to leave heaven to get out of there. Maybe there was some kind of professional jealousy from Mark Twain, you know, to Sam Jones. I mean, Jones, the kind of humor that Jones uses, that he weaves, is Twainian in a way. It's similar to Mark Twain's.
I'd rather be a first-class sinner than a 10th-rate Methodist. And when you get a Methodist down to about a 10th-rate Methodist, you're getting them down pretty low, for a first-class one is not very high. When I first started out, I was afraid I would hurt somebody's feelings. Now I'm afraid I won't.
In the United States, all through the 19th century and well into the 20th century, ministers have used humor. America doesn't have a state religion, so these different denominations are vying with each other to gain the most adherence. And what better way to do that than with witticisms, with sort of backwoods jokes, funny things that will draw attention to your work and to the gospel.
I'll stand with a sword in hand and fight the devil till the blade is worn out and drops from my hand. And then I will hit him until my arms wear out, and kick him until I kick my feet off, and then gnaw him as long as I got a tooth. When my teeth play out, I will gum him until I die.
Randall Stevens is a historian at Northumbria University in the UK. He wrote the introduction to a recent edition of Jones's sermons, entitled, appropriately enough, Sam Jones's Own Book, A Series of Sermons.
It's time for another break. When we get back, a revival leader who spread the good news the same way we do, with the help of the radio airwaves.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Backstory. I'm Brian Ballow, here with my fellow sinners, Peter Onuf's one of them.
Oh, Brian, I'm here.
And Ed Ayers is the other.
That's me.
Today on the show, we're exploring the history of Christian revival in America. We've considered a couple of prominent 19th century revivalists. Now we're going to turn the page to the early decades of the 20th century.
It was then that a new religious movement cropped up in the Midwest among Christians who had had it with the rigid formality of middle-class Protestant churches. Pentecostalism, as it came to be known, encouraged raucous and joyous worship practices inspired by the earliest days of the Christian church. Its adherents longed for converts to speak in tongues and to practice faith healing, just as the apostles had done in the New Testament account of the Pentecost. The resurgence of these divine acts, Pentecostals believed, was evidence that the return of Christ was imminent.
By the 1910s, Pentecostal camp meetings were cropping up across the country. And it was on this revival circuit that a young woman from Ontario named Amy Semple McPherson began to make a name for herself. Charismatic and entertaining, the young woman quickly became a star of the circuit.
I think she was a born religious leader in a time when that was not a common life story for women.
This is Tona Hangen, a historian who has written about McPherson. Hangen says that from the earliest days of her ministry, McPherson knew how to use unorthodox means to spread the good word.
She had this battered black car that she called the gospel car, and she would put slogans on the side of it. Where will you spend eternity? Or judgment day is coming, get right with God. And she and her kids and her mother went up and down in small towns, tobacco fields, camp meetings, all along the year.
McPherson, known by her followers as Sister Amy, eventually settled in Los Angeles, where in 1923 she built her own version of what today we'd call a megachurch. But she quickly discovered an even more effective means of spreading the good word, a means that a lot of you listeners can probably appreciate today, radio.
Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Come, come, come.
For Sister Amy, the combination of the Christian gospel and the radio airwaves was a match made in heaven.
She, I think, had always had an affinity for media, as the bumper stickers on her car suggests, that she was always looking for more ways to amplify her voice and to right. make this revivalism message have a broader appeal. So in Los Angeles, like any other big city in the early 1920s, radio was just beginning to take off. There were a few people, a few hundred thousand people with radio sets. There were a few broadcasters. And she imagined, as an extension of her ministry and of this congregation that she was forming there, that she could, again, amplify this message by using radio. And she's truly visionary in seeing the possibilities.
And how did she go about that? It's one thing to want to use radio. It's another thing to get access to radio in those days, I would imagine.
It is. This is before the Federal Radio Commission. So we don't have, which is the predecessor of the FCC. There's no regulatory body. So you can get a radio license. That's not the hard part. And then you build, a receiver and a transmitter and a studio. That's the hard part. So she sets off on a fundraising campaign that takes about a year, 1923 to 1924. She's produced a magazine by this point that goes out to her various followers around the country. And she asks for donations by pointing out that, as she put it, the world had already captured the moving pictures. And she said, shall we let them have the radio too? Or shall we say, this is her speaking, no, this is Father's air and earth, and we will send the message upon its breezes to spread the gospel in this wholesale and miraculous manner. And over a period of about a year, she raised $25,000 and constructed a huge 500-watt broadcasting facility with its radio towers mounted on the top of this domed temple that she had built. And it became one of the very earliest radio stations in Los Angeles. It's probably within the top five. And she's one of the first women, if not the first woman, to hold a radio station license.
Now, I assume there were other preachers using the radio at this time?
There were people preaching on radio using borrowed or purchased time, sometimes just for a portion of a Sunday. What she envisioned was something different. She pioneered a station that would be fully owned by a church and that would be on air all the time. That's the new piece. And so she had a seven-day-a-week schedule of programming unlike anything else that anyone else is doing in the mid-1920s. She's really the only one who's doing this.
So I understand it was very innovative to have a station devoted entirely to religion. What about the content? Why don't you compare the way the radio ministry worked to some of those camp meetings a few years before she started the radio ministry?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the camp meetings involved audiences a lot more integrally than her radio ministry did. The radio ministry, I think, becomes a theater where Sunday morning and afternoon services are happening in the church. She packs that temple full of people, and the performances are simulcast. And so there's this sense of theater and glamour. But then she also has programs that are more intimate in scale, that come from the broadcast studio, things like a program designed just for people who are sick or shut in, sort of aimed at hospital patients and the like. A call-in request show of hymns, the Vesper Hour, which would be kind of like a quieter devotional reading. In some years, she had a weekly travel log. She had the Foursquare Junior Hour for children. And she also offered, which I think is kind of fascinating, she offered weekly dramas, like radio dramas. This is the era of shows like, you know, Superman and the Green Hornet and The Adventures of Sam Spade. And she had weekly dramas with names like The Adventures of Jim Trask, Lone Evangelist. And she also did faith healing without direct physical contact. She did that over the radio as well. She would literally have listeners kneel by the radio and place their hands on it in order to receive long-distance cures. She believed if the Holy Spirit could travel over the airwaves, that so could the healing power of Jesus Christ.
And was she acknowledged as the leading practitioner of radio, I almost said televangelism, audio evangelism?
I think she's acknowledged now, but at the time, no. I think she was seen as a gimmick by people who didn't follow or believe her. She was seen as not very serious, as in some ways corrupting the message by interweaving all this pop culture to it. Newspaper commentators at the time roundly dismissed her and her congregation for their lowbrow pretensions.
What does this chapter about McPherson tell us about the larger religious picture, particularly regarding revivals in evangelicalism?
I think it tells us two things. First, that radio as a new technology ironically prevented old-time religion from dying out in the modern century. People were worried that old-time religion was going to be less relevant, that it was dying out. And I think the message of McPherson's ministry is that that didn't happen. As secularism grows, so does revivalism in response. I think the second thing we learn is that radio connected religion to the nation's premier entertainment medium, which people consumed in their homes. Revivalists who used media like radio had to sell it. They had to adopt modern marketing and advertising and psychology and business methods. And that was irreversible. Once media and religion got connected together, and McPherson is really the glue for this, she's the bridge, they never get separated. And I think we see early radio ministries as a bridge to later mass media ministries, the Christian broadcasting and marketing juggernaut. And it's slick and it's commercial in its own way. But McPherson did not see it as a fundamental transformation. She saw it as a fulfillment of the Great Commission to preach the gospel in all the world. The same old gospel in new packaging, just reinvigorated with new meaning and new relevance for each generation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Backstory today, Tona.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
My precious Lord.
Tona Hengen is a historian at Worcester State University. She's the author of Redeeming the Dial, Radio, Religion, and Popular Culture in America.
My precious Lord has won my heart, and never from him will I part.
I ain't gonna
grieve. I ain't gonna grieve.
My Lord anymore.
My Lord anymore.
If you're just joining us, this is Backstory, and we're marking the Easter season with stories about Christian revival in America, from the First Great Awakening to the age of broadcast evangelism. We're going to move on now to one of the best-known figures in American religious history, Billy Graham.
One of the most inspirational spiritual leaders of the 20th century.
We need you, we love you. Thank you for coming, Billy Graham.
What is your purpose?
Go into the whole world and proclaim this message.
You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
Shall make you free. Shall make you free.
This epic montage is from a 2013 Fox News special about the Reverend Billy Graham. It includes comments by Johnny Carson and Larry King, as well as a few of the 12 U.S. presidents, 12, that he's met over the years. Graham, who's now 96 years old, has held revivals all over the world. His audiences have numbered in the millions. It's safe to say his influence is unparalleled by any preacher in American history. But his rise to stardom was sudden.
In the 1940s, when Graham came into the scene, there were dozens of conspicuous revivalists, and by 1950, there was no competition.
This is Grant Wacker, a historian at Duke and the author of a recent book on Graham. He says this sea change can be pinpointed to one particular event in the fall of 1949. That's when Billy Graham, this itinerant preacher from North Carolina, pitched his tent in Los Angeles. The revival, which he actually called a crusade, was supposed to be a three-week stint.
In the beginning, the crusade did not fare well. The attendance was mediocre, and Graham and his associates became discouraged.
Like any good preacher, Graham prayed for something to happen. Hoping for divine intervention, he kept his tent pitched for one more week.
And it was in the fourth week that Graham came into the tent one afternoon, and there were reporters all over. Reporters started writing down his comments, and he was astonished. He was a very young man at this point, in his early 30s. Bulbs are popping, and these reporters are taking notes. And so he asked, naturally, you know, what's happened here? Why are you writing down everything that I'm saying? And one of the reporters said to him, "You have been kissed by William Randolph Hearst."
William Randolph Hearst, owner of a newspaper empire and all-around media mogul. He had apparently told his reporters to start writing articles about Graham's L.A. gathering.
Almost immediately, the Los Angeles Times, which Hearst did not own, picked it up. Within a few days, Time magazine picked it up, then Life magazine, and the story went to Europe and it went to Asia.
The press attention attracted scores of gawkers, many of whom came out of pure curiosity. But the crowds continued to build. Graham's popularity, Wacker says, was contagious.
The kind of truck stop mentality. If there are a lot of cars parked outside, a lot of trucks, this must be good. The press presented this as a landmark in the history of American revivalism.
Soon, a space that could seat 3,000 was expanded to accommodate 9,000. On one occasion, it was estimated that another 15,000 stood outside listening. And what of the man at the center of all this attention? Well, the content of Graham's sermons wasn't all that unique. He hit all the familiar notes of revival preaching, troubles of the world, personal issues, personal salvation. What set Graham apart was his presence and his delivery. He was tall, handsome, and commanding. His voice boomed at a lightning clip. Here's a sample from the L.A. revival.
And I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost part of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel.
Stenographers clocked his preaching at 240 words a minute. Very, very rapidly pronounced. And he did that deliberately because he felt that successful newscasters spoke very, very rapidly. He also was loud, and that volume gave the sermon a commanding quality. He was animated. He paced the platform. One account, he often paced a full mile in the course of a sermon. And then the gestures with his fists, fingers stabbing outward. One reporter said he had the energy of a coiled panther.
And I hope that Jesus designates to me a little part of Los Angeles. There are a few things I'd like to clean up around this town if he could put me in charge.
Peppering his sermons were appearances from figures sure to play well in glitzy L.A. Radio personalities, actresses, and athletes took turns testifying to the power of Graham's message.
The word of the satisfied customer, to put it in marketing terms. And he understood that this was more powerful than any kind of technical theological apologetic.
And all of this gave the press yet another story to tell. Newspapers across the country and around the world were fascinated by the fascination with Graham. The revival, originally slotted for a 3-week run, lasted for 2 months.
And by the end of the crusade, Graham was an international commodity.
The story of Billy Graham's lightning fame at the hands of William Randolph Hearst has become something of a legend. It's been told time and again in Graham's circles. But it does leave one question unanswered.
So the question is, why? Why did Hearst give him this attention? Hearst was not known to be a particularly religious man, and he certainly was not known to be an evangelical figure like Graham.
The truth is, no one really knows why Hearst turned his attention to Billy Graham. But Grant Wacker has an idea. He doesn't buy the notion that Hearst just saw Graham's genius and promoted it. He thinks all the attention was actually a response to bigger forces, international forces.
2 days before the revival started, the Soviets had successfully exploded an atomic bomb. And Harry Truman announced this. And by all accounts, people were frightened to know that now another nation that was in the grip of this atheistic, aggressive ideology known as communism possessed nuclear weaponry and could inflict terrible damage upon Americans.
About a week later, communists, led by Mao Zedong, toppled the Chinese government.
And this was an evidence that, to people, including Graham, that communism was aggressive, it was expansionist, and they intended to conquer the world, including the United States. The world is in dire condition.
One of these days, an earthquake, a tidal wave, an atomic bomb is going to wipe this city off the face of the globe unless they repent like Nineveh did and escape the judgment of God.
That was the background of anxiety, fear, awareness that it was possible that the world really could be destroyed.
And we're told that there are more subversive forces in Los Angeles than any city in America. I tell you, if there was ever an hour that Los Angeles needs to come to its knees before God, it's the present hour in which we're living.
Hearst was a smart newsman. He no doubt recognized the value of a really good story, a story about frightening times, the individual sitting in that tent, and, of course, God. It's a story that has always been a part of Billy Graham's sermons. But Los Angeles, 1949, was a moment when that story was particularly compelling. And Graham tapped into that energy.
We've seen see starvation around the world that testifies that something is wrong. We see a bleeding China.
Thanks to Grant Wacker for helping us tell that story. He's a historian at Duke University. His most recent book is America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation.
And that is all we have for you today. We've reached the end times. But we'd love to hear what you thought about today's show. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org. We've also got descriptions of our upcoming shows there, including one on technologies that have changed the workplace and one on the theme of speed in American history. You can leave us a comment or give us a call on our voicemail line. Our number is 434-260-1053. We're also on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, Kelly Jones, Emily Gaddick, and Robert Armengol. Jamal Milner is our engineer. We had help from Coley Elhai. Special thanks this week to Steve Zeleny, Tisa Wenger, the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton College, and the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, and also to Adam Brock, who performed the sermons of Sam Jones. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional funding is provided by Weinstein Properties, by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment, and by History Channel, history made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
Backstory is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.